This is Nick Beer, interviewed at his home at Lanford, near Salisbury in Wiltshire, on the 15th of February 2009, by Chris Eldon Lee. Nick Beer, Part 1.
Nicholas Anthony Beer, I was born in Epsom in Surrey on the 7th of October 1949.
And what was your first job after school?
I went to sea. I went to a nautical college the Worcester boarding school between 13, the age of 13 and 17. So I was contracted to Portline, which was a shipping company that ran out to Australia and New Zealand and brought back refrigerated cargo, meat and apples and things.
What's a young chap from Epsom doing going to sea?
Well, I don't know. None of my family. I'd have to go back probably three generations. And on my mother's side, there was an engineer at sea. But other than that, I'm the first in the family, really. So I tell you, the reason that I went to sea is because my brother, who was 4 years older than me, was getting career brochures from his school. And I saw one with a picture of a merchant navy officer in tropical uniform on the wing of the bridge in the tropics, taking a sight with a sextant. And I thought that was pretty good. That looked pretty attractive. And I found out that actually, to go to sea, the best time to make up your mind was the age that I was at that time. So unfortunately, my parents were able to help me and get me to school, pay for the school fees at Worcester, and so off I went.
So it was more of a fashion statement, was it, than a career?
I think almost, yeah, almost. And once pretty well everybody at Worcester went to sea. You only didn't go to sea if you failed your eyesight test finally. So probably 19 out of 20 people went to sea into the Merchant Navy. So I was taught seamanship and navigation and nautical knowledge. And we were running around in boats because the ship was actually off the shore in the Thames down at Greenhithe. So pretty well prepared to go to sea.
So did you in fact go to that college with going to sea in mind?
Oh yes, yes.
So at quite an early age you were intending to go to sea?
Yes, at 13 I decided I wanted to join the Merchant Navy, and it's all started from there really.
Did your parents encourage you, discourage you?
No, they didn't do either, really. They must have encouraged me, I suppose. I don't remember them. Certainly not discouraging me. No, they were all for it. And looking back, I don't think I'd have changed that or very much anyway.
What was life with Portline like?
It was good in those days. My first trip, I joined the ship. It was 1967, January 1967. Flew out to New York to join a ship, and in those days we lived pretty well. We carried 12 passengers on Portline ships, so that it was, they were very smart ships. So we had good accommodation, very good food, very smart uniforms. It was all every evening was. Mess dress, bow ties, and 7-course meals if you could eat it all, and it was a pretty good life really.
But you were also viewing a career where did you have captaincy in your sights?
I think yeah. I mean, you have to. You're starting off as an apprentice, then the end of the road is captain. But in those days, you tended to think that you'd be have to work for 20 years before you became a master. Things changed actually, and over the next 5 or 6 years after I started at sea, the labour, there was a general shortage of labour, and maybe more ships were being built. I'm not really sure of the reason, but promotion came pretty easily for a while for British officers anyway. So the people were getting promoted into master's positions and senior officer positions pretty early on.
So do you feel you were striving to be promoted, or did you have it kind of thrust upon you, as Marvolio might say?
I think it just happened. I don't think it isn't competitive in that way. generally you reached a certain stage, got another certificate of competency, and then you'd get your promotion.
Did you stay with Portline all your?
No, I didn't. I did a 4-year or 3-year apprenticeship with Portline, but the life was rapidly changing within Portline over the 3 years that I was there, so I left them and I actually went out to Australia for a year and worked on a small cruise liner all around the South Pacific Islands and New Zealand, and then in the austral winter we'd go up to cruises from Australia up to Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong. So that was a pretty good relaxing time, actually.
That was fairly easy sailing, was it?
Very easy, because we'd done most of the routes before. It was very easy navigation, and there was no cargo work or anything. And in fact, as one of the junior officers, I was expected really to entertain the passengers to some extent, to stand on board the ship and also to ashore, taking them around places.
How were your dancing skills?
Oh, good, yeah. I wanted to, because it was 350 Australian passengers, and a lot of them were seemed to be a lot of young Australian secretaries and people like that going on holiday. And it was 180 Chinese crew. The only two European officers on board, the only two crew members that were under about the age of about 25, were myself and one of the radio officers. So we were quite sought after.
Mm. How was it working with Chinese crew?
Difficult, actually. There was some really tense times with them.
How do you mean?
Well, there was one occasion. One occasion where the second engineer was chased around the passageway by a mob of Chinese, with sticks and threatening to kill him. And there was another time when there was a very bad injury on board when a number of Chinese were fighting over gambling debts. But I found them, the second engineer that was in trouble with them was in trouble because he treated them appallingly, I think. I found them really very personable and I got on very well with them indeed. And they worked very hard. So I enjoyed that experience.
What was your first captain's post?
The first time I was captain was when I was appointed to look after the building of the James Clark Ross.
Oh, right.
In 1988.
So how did that come about?
Well, they needed... I'd been a chief officer for 15 years, and I also had an extra master's ticket. But the four masters that had been masters ever since I was promoted to chief officer, they were promoted to master at the same time, and so they were the two ships that we were operating then, the Bransfield and the John Biscoe, were operational. They were going down to the Antarctic each summer, so they needed somebody else to look after the building of the new ship and to be ashore. And I could have either taken over one of the ships as master, the Biscoe or the Bransfield, and left one of the masters to come, the existing masters to come ashore and do that job, or indeed I could have been promoted to into that job, and for some reason I was promoted into doing that job.
So that wasn't your first encounter with Bass then? You'd worked for Bass?
No, I'd worked for Bass after the year in Australia. I applied to spend another, I'd been 12 months on board the ship, and that was the end of my contract, but I applied to do another, to carry on and do another 6 months. I was enjoying myself so much, but they thought that I ought to go back and take my ticket, my next certificate of competency. So I did that, and on reflection, when I was back taking my examinations, I realised that navigationally and as far as my career was concerned, it wasn't a particularly challenging job. It was really enjoyable, but it wasn't challenging. And that's when I was looking around for something else.
So it was career building.
It was. And also something, I mean, I think it was looking for a challenge, especially a navigation and seamanship challenge. And a friend of mine had joined the Bransfield as third officer. And I was really interested in what he had to say. So it was through him, his introduction, that I was interviewed on board the Bransford and given the job.
Can you remember the interview?
Oh, I can. It was with Tom Woodfield, and it was in the dry dock. It wasn't a dry dock, but in a shipyard in Southampton, and it lasted about half an hour or so. It was just a chat. I can't remember exactly what he asked me, but...
So was it already in the bag, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I think the there wasn't a great deal of competition. It was quite difficult to find officers, British officers, and that was at the time, just when promotion was becoming quite easy. So I joined as third officer in 1972.
When they asked you, why do you want this job, why do you want to go to the Antarctic, what was your likely reply?
The likely reply would have been, I mean, it would sound a bit trite maybe, but the challenge and especially the difficulty of with navigation and the experience of working in ice. So that was all quite a genuine desire, and really exciting, I thought was a really exciting prospect at that time.
So you did almost 20 years then, and forth?
I did 22 years before leaving for a job ashore. And I did one voyage, 1972 to 73, as third officer, a full 8-month voyage. And then another 8-month voyage, I was second officer. And then I was promoted to chief officer. So I was, in 1974, I was chief officer at the age of 25.
Chief officer is second in command to the captain.
Yes.
Yeah. And there you stayed for a while.
I stayed as chief officer until 1988.
And so you worked on both the Briscoe and the Bransfield?
I worked on the Briscoe for 2 years. 2 years in early 80s for 2 years, 81 and 82, I think. And then I went back to the Bransfield again. And I think that was just because to have a change or something. It wasn't at my request. I actually had a year on the Polar Stern, the German icebreaker, in 1981. I think that's why I left the Bransfield. I was seconded to go on to the Polar Stern on its maiden voyage as the sort of ice pilot, which was a really, really interesting voyage, because at that time it was a really modern, well, brand new, well-equipped, powerful ship. The power that British Antarctic Survey ships could only dream of in terms of ice breaking and ice working capability. And the one of the challenges of that maiden voyage was to test the specifications that the ship had been built to. So we were actively searching ice to break and measuring it and scientifically trying to show that the ship was capable of doing what it was designed to do.
So were you pushing it beyond its limits?
Yeah, pushing it right to its limits. But it was designed actually to break 2.5 meter thick ice in a continuous head movement. But what it was almost impossible to find level ice of 2 meters, 2.5 meter thickness, because inevitably in the Antarctic there's pressure ridges every few meters, and you just couldn't find this uniform thickness of ice.
You were looking for a Torvald and Dean and didn't get it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
what does an ice pilot do then? I mean,
The captain of the ship had never been to the Antarctic before.
Right.
He was a German container ship captain from a company called Hapag-Lloyd. And Hapag-Lloyd had got the contract to man and operate the ship, which was owned by the German scientific institute, or the German government, and so that the captain had never been south before. That's not true. He'd done one voyage. He'd been sent as an observer on another ship. It wasn't one of our ships, into the Antarctic for a month or two on the previous season. But I think Dick Laws actually offered to have one of send one of our officers. And once again, it could have been one of the masters that went, but they, you know, for some reason I was selected to go and do it. And it was a pretty tricky time because the master, the Hapag-Lloyd master, didn't really want me. He didn't feel the need to have me. The chief scientist, it was a very autocratic chap, well known to British Antarctic Survey people. A very nice chap, but he was on the maiden voyage as well. But he wanted me on board in order to satisfy probably insurance requirements and to make sure that the master didn't do anything silly, so that I had had a fine line to tread between satisfying the job that I had doing the job that I was being paid to do on there, without upsetting one side or the other, really.
Were there any flashpoints?
Not really. I think I managed it pretty well. There were a couple of times when I had to take the master aside and give him some advice that he didn't really want, because he was being slightly foolhardy. He wasn't aware that he was taking risks, but he didn't really understand, I think, the how difficult the or the accuracy of the charts for a start. I mean, he was. I remember one time that he'd planned a course through an area which had no soundings, but he had assumed, because there was no soundings, that it must be deep water, and what it actually meant was that it hadn't been surveyed.
Yeah. So he was taking the maps too literally.
Yeah, yeah.
An ice pilot presumably spends most of their time avoiding ice, but for once you were actually looking for it.
We were on that occasion, yes, and we spent some time in the Weddell Sea looking for as thick uniform level ice. We found some in some bays, but it wasn't really quite right. And then we went looking for heavy sea ice to just see how well she performed in those conditions. So we ended up going into an area that I'd never been to before or since with the British Antarctic Survey, to the west of the Weddell Sea, right. Northwest side of the Weddell Sea.
So the polar stern passed with flying colours.
Oh, it did, and it's still operational down there. Right. Now 28 years later, so she's absolutely superb ship.
So your ambition was to make sure the James Clark Ross passed with flying colours.
Yes,
as well.
It was, and I think. Although I haven't, I mean, only hear from its present masters, but and press reports and things. But I believe that it has a really good reputation. So I feel that it has been a big success. Certainly in my years as master on there, the first few voyages, it worked really well, and all the reports from the scientific community was that it was a good ship.
What did you gather in your time on the Biscoe and Bransfield, which you felt equipped you to go into that meeting room with the builders, with Swan Hunters and scientists, to start mapping out this new ship?
I think that both the Biscoe and Bransfield had really good aspects to both of them, and the Bransfield in particular, I think, was actually were both extremely successful ships. I think I've always been a bit of a Luddite in that. The temptation might have been to actually go modern in every respect. I mean, there was certainly quite a demand for cafeteria style eating mess rooms on board, to cut down the barriers between officers and scientists and crew members. And my experience indicated to me that it was best to try and maintain. I mean, we actually did lower the barriers to some extent, make the divide a little less less stringent, but nevertheless, we maintained, we tried to maintain certain standards on board of uniform and the standards of accommodation and fit out, which hopefully was able to. And I'd had some experience visiting other ships, that modern ships, where it was more like the living accommodation was really utilitarian, had no style, and I didn't think that was appropriate for the British Antarctic Survey. So it was that experience of nearly 16, 17 years on Bransfield and Biscoe that I rather liked the idea of reproducing a Bransfield and Biscoe, but with modern furniture and equipment and the best possible scientific fit out, best possible bridge design and equipment, and but everything rock solid really, so that it would last for 20 or 30 years. But of course there were consultants and consultant naval architects that brought in the detailed design work. They were just, but I worked with them from even a year, 18 months before we actually laid the first steel plate down.
But were there things that your time on the Biscoe and particularly the Bransfield, you thought to yourself, no way am I having this on my new ship? Were there failings on those ships which you were determined not to replicate?
I don't think there were failings in that respect. I mean, the big failure of Bransfield was her manoeuvrability, and the fact that she was completely underpowered for the task that she was given. So, we needed a highly manoeuvrable and the very powerful. I mean, the highest power that we could actually realistically achieve. The problem with, as you go up in power, then the expense, the fuel consumption goes up and it becomes uneconomic. So we had to draw a line, but we needed a manoeuvrable, powerful ship, much more so than Bransfield. And of course, Biscoe was even worse, and she couldn't really sniff ice and she'd get stuck.
There were bow and stern thrusters
on the James Scott Ross.
That
yes.
Was your insistence?
I was pushing an open door, so they wouldn't have had any disagreement on that. I mean, the stern thrusters are needed really for positioning for scientific work rather than manoeuvring alongside to discharge cargo or alongside a jetty, but. And also because although we didn't have dynamic positioning when the ship was built, it was always an aspiration that would be retrofitted at a later date. And you would have needed the stern thrusters in order to achieve dynamic positioning.
And were the things from your year with the polar stern that you made a note of to bring up at these planning meetings, design meetings?
Probably. I mean, I can't. Polar stern was a very powerful, very manoeuvrable ship. I have a feeling that there were some particular things that I brought from polar stern, but I can't honestly remember what they were now.
Were you listened to?
Yes. Oh, yes. Without a doubt. And it was from Swan Hunter's point of view, the builders. It was a real tonic to have one of the operators in the. I was the team for the first few months before finally a chief engineer joined me, but to have the final operator there, they really enjoyed that, and we were able to modify things even at a late stage, and they were very willing to do that. They were a really good company, actually. It's very sad that they've. Yeah, well, soon after the James Scott Ross, they changed hands and went to the war.
You had to marry the requirements of seamen and scientists, didn't you? The boat had to be a really good boat for the seamen's point of view, but also a particularly good boat from the scientist's scientist point of view. And I can't believe that didn't result in some compromises. Was there any tensions that had to be resolved?
There were. I chaired a meeting, occasionally chaired a meeting. I think it was about 32-odd representatives from the scientific community, the eventual user community. And, of course, everybody had very big ideas about what they would like. And it would have been impossible to fit all those things on. As it is, I mean, one of the criticisms of James Scott Ross might be that we tried to fit too much on, because it was the engine spaces in particular were very cramped, only because of the amount of auxiliary machinery and winches and things that we crammed into the small space. We'd have liked the James Clark Ross to have been bigger, but expense dictated that it couldn't grow more than the size that she ended up.
She had to be quiet as well.
Yes.
How do you manage that?
Well, I mean,
with
using naval expertise learnt in the building of naval ships, and Swan Hunters were well equipped to deal with that. And when we took it out on the naval acoustic trials area up in the northwest Scotland, and I think she performed very well. But that was at the optimum time when we actually sailed from the on trials. The ship had just been built. It was always bound to get worse as the ship grew older, and housekeeping on board, you couldn't have maintained the same standard of cleanliness. It would only need tools to be left lying around and that sort of thing that would to really drastically affect the acoustic signature of the ship. But all the engines had huge double rubber mountings, and I think it was an interesting challenge, but the technical side of that was, of course, handled by consultants. And
why were the scientists so desperate to have a quiet ship? What was it? What was the?
It was so that they could tow acoustic arrays and with hydrophones and listening to that to their so that there would be less interference with their being able to listen to their own instruments, I think that was really very, very important to the and not exaggerated, I think, because so much of the marine science at that stage was dependent on having good acoustic, being able to listen to the finer details of.
What were they listening to? Listening to the bottom or to squids or?
Both, actually. They would. Yes, on the marine biology side, they'd be listening for whales and I don't know whether squids make a noise, but probably. But then it's mostly the biggest push in that way was from the geophysicists that. We had a multi-beam echo sounder on board, which you could either tow the transducer from astern of the vessel, and that was to get it away as far away from the ship as possible, so that you wouldn't get any interference. Or you could we had the ability to be able to have use the transducer mounted in the hull of the vessel, and of course, then that's when you need the low noise